Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Frank Talks to Anyone. I've got a special guest today. How do I pronounce your last name? Is it Lupik?
Lupik.
Okay, good. I got it right. This is Travis Lupik. He's a reporter for the Georgia Strait. And I ran into his book randomly when I wanted to find out what was happening in my city on the downtown east side. And his book's called Fighting for Space. What was the second part of the title?
Fighting for Space, How a Group of Drug Users Transformed One City's Struggle with Addiction.
Exactly, and that was the first book that showed up when on my Google search when I was trying to figure out what the hell is happening with my city. And I guess we'll start first with, how did you start in journalism?
I've been working for the Georgia Strait newspaper for just over 10 years now. I started here as an intern and then tricked the company into keeping me around after I graduated university. Been with the paper off and on ever since, and in 2016, found myself covering the drug crisis in Vancouver for the Georgia Strait. And that prompted me to take a look back at history, at the history of the city's drug problem, and that became the book, Fighting for Space.
Right. So at the beginning of the book, it starts with, what was the hotel? The Portland Hotel. And there was would you say that's the beginning of harm reduction? Is that like the pioneer? Were they the pioneers of harm reduction? And can you explain what harm reduction is to people who don't know?
Yeah. Harm reduction is a category, a field of healthcare that seeks to reduce harms associated with problematic drug use. The easiest example is needle exchange. If somebody is going to use an intravenous drug like cocaine or heroin, you can reduce the harm associated with that drug use by providing them with a clean needle, therefore minimizing the risks of the spread of disease, of HIV, of hepatitis C. So that's harm reduction. If somebody's going to use drugs no matter what, give them a clean needle so that they don't use a dirty needle and contract hepatitis C. In the early 1990s, those very diseases, hepatitis C and HIV, were a huge problem in the poorest neighborhood of Vancouver, the downtown east side. We had the highest rate of HIV outside of sub-Saharan Africa. And I fact-checked that for the book, and it's true.
Wow.
At the same time, we had an overdose crisis similar to the crisis that we face, that all of North America faces today. So into this health crisis of the early 1990s, hepatitis C, HIV, and overdose deaths, you had a young woman named Liz Evans, a nurse show up in the downtown east side. She was given a contract to provide mental health care services inside 10 rooms in a beat-up old hotel called the Portland Hotel. And though nobody was calling it harm reduction at the time, the day that Liz Evans was handed that hotel in 1991 is really the start of Vancouver's harm reduction story.
Right. What really stood out to me when I was reading about that was, I guess this is where the name of the book comes, Fighting for Space, how I think it was Liz who would figure out the quirks of the inhabitants, of people who lived in the hotel, and she would try to understand how to make them feel more comfortable. Like, the hotel would be a safe space for these people to not be judged. If they needed to use their drugs, they had somebody watching over them. They would put a bucket outside their bedrooms if they needed to vomit and stuff like that. And it wasn't like the harsh reality of being on the street is much different than having somebody actually care for you.
Yeah, the title for the book, Fighting for Space, is with much gratitude stolen from Liz Evans.
Okay.
The original title was Creating Space, which is a phrase that Liz is always using. When she was given the Portland Hotel, there was no grand motive in mind. There was no large goal or plan in place. Liz was simply trying to be kind to people. So when she was given the hotel, on paper, she was to provide mental health care to 10 rooms. In reality, the entire hotel and its 70 rooms were hers to run as she saw fit. There wasn't a housing crisis in Vancouver at the time. There were actually vacancies at the Portland Hotel, tough to believe today. So the first thing that Liz did with her partner, Mark Townsend, after not too much time, was began filling up that hotel, taking people in off the streets, people who with severe mental health disorders, people with severe addictions to intravenous drugs like cocaine and heroin. Liz took an informal survey of the tenants that she brought into the Portland Hotel that first year. And the average number of addresses that her tenants had had during the preceding 12 months was 11. These were people that were evicted literally every few weeks again and again. They could not be housed, so the logic went at the time. And Liz rejected that, and she said, "No, you live here now. You're always going to live here. This is your home. We're not going to kick you out if you experience a mental health outburst and break a window. We're not going to kick you out if you're caught using drugs. We're not going to kick you out if somebody overdoses and you call down reporting that overdose." And there was this really neat unintended consequence. Liz found when you remove that stress, that threat of eviction for drug use and mental health emergencies, the unintended consequence was people actually used less drugs and actually experienced fewer mental health outbursts. It wasn't a grand plan at the time. Liz was just trying to be kind, but it had that really neat unintended consequence of stabilizing people's lives.
Right. It really, another thing that stood out to me when you wrote about that was when you said that she took a lot of these people out camping and gave them like community events and feelings that you wouldn't otherwise get when you're living on the street. Like, how often do these people get to go camping and like get feel these community activities that I would feel as a normal person living in North Van who's not dealing with all this trauma and stress? Where,
yeah, the old Portland's camping trips. If you are homeless on the streets of the downtown east side and maintaining an addiction to cocaine with 15 injections a day, you don't have too many opportunities to leave Vancouver and go on a camping trip out at Manning Park. And that's the opportunity that Liz and the Portland gave the tenants of the Portland Hotel those first few years in the early mid-1990s. So they would rent a school bus and do these big trips out to Manning Park or Cultus Lake and take people on what for so many others is a normal activity, a weekend out of town camping.
And I think, maybe I'm making this up, but I think in the book you said that some of the persons that were taken, they said that they had never gone camping before. And suddenly these two people decide to care about them. And
this was a group of extremely marginalized people. Trauma was often generational. It didn't even just begin with them. It began with their parents or even their grandparents. So these were people who were raised in poverty, raised around drugs and alcohol addictions. And again, it wasn't a grand strategy. Liz was just trying to be kind. But they found that therapeutic programs, like getting out of town for a weekend, actually had a lot of benefits.
Right. Now I'm going to fast forward really far. But another thing that really interested me about your book was the idea for, especially right now during the opioid crisis, is prescription heroin, for example, and how it's not widely available. And you have I have the guy's name written down here. I don't know his first name, but his last name was Thompson, and he started using prescription heroin 3 times a day, and he found that he no longer had to spend the whole day hustling to buy his drugs. So he found his time opening up, he got a job, and he started helping people in the same situation as himself.
Yeah, you're talking about Kevin Thompson.
Yes.
If Vancouver's history, its story with harm reduction began in the early 1990s, 1990-91 with Liz Evans and the Portland Hotel. Its latest chapter, its ongoing chapter, began in 2014-15 with North America's only prescription heroin program, a program that exists at the corner of Hastings and Abbott called Crosstown Clinic. Kevin Thompson is one of the patients at Crosstown Clinic. He spent years on the streets, homeless, committing petty crimes to feed an addiction to street heroin. And then Kevin enrolled in this, at the time, an experimental program at Crosstown Clinic. So 3 times a day, Kevin can visit the clinic and, having met with a doctor, 3 times a day receives a very specific, very pure, measured dose of prescription heroin. The medical term is diacetylmorphine. And what this allows Kevin to do is really just get on with his life. He's out of the hustle. He doesn't have to deal with petty crimes, shoplifting, dealing on the side or whatever. He doesn't have to deal with drug dealers. He doesn't, crucially, especially in the age of fentanyl, Kevin doesn't have to deal with the uncertainty of street dealers and the uncertainty of their supply. Kevin always knows what he's getting. It's always the exact same dose, so he doesn't really even get high off it anymore. This is just maintenance. And what it's done is given Kevin the time to get back to his life. For the first time in more than a decade, he's rejoined the legitimate economy. Kevin has a job. He's still addicted to heroin, still uses the drug 3 times a day, but he also goes to work every morning.
Right, and he's also helping his peers, and I'm pretty sure he commented that he was trying to wean himself off.
Yeah, the job that Kevin took was at one of the city of Vancouver's new overdose prevention sites, one of its new sort of stripped-down injection sites, where Kevin helps people who were previously in his situation, street users, that sort of thing. He helps them get through the fentanyl crisis. He revives people from overdoses. He saves lives. Reducing his dose, similar to the story of Liz Evans in the early 1990s, Kevin reducing his dose was an unintended consequence. The goal of Crosstown Clinic's prescription heroin program was stabilization, simply keeping people alive, getting them out of the hustle. But again, there was this really neat unintended consequence. Remove that stress, remove the stress of the street hustle, give people some time to think about themselves, their life, their mental health. And there's this neat unintended consequence where Kevin has felt that he hasn't needed to do the amount of drugs that he once felt he needed to do. And on his own accord, without pressures from the program, he has significantly reduced his dose.
Right. And this is like especially important now that you read in the book that 2011 was when fentanyl showed up on our streets. And this isn't like with heroin, it might kill you slowly, but fentanyl can kill you the first time you try it, depending on the dose and whether it's carfentanyl.
Yeah,
can you talk about that?
2011 is sort of our baseline year for overdose data because there were just a few more than 200 overdoses a year. For a province the size of British Columbia, about 200 fatal overdoses per year is, for lack of a better term, a normal number. Then fentanyl showed up in 2012, 2013, 2014, more each year, and that number grew substantially from 200 fatal overdoses about in 2011 to an expected 1,500 fatal overdoses this year, 2018.
Holy.
So, you know, in 7 years, a multiple of seven times. That is a very sharp increase.
I've seen people arguing on Twitter, and I wanted to ask you this. Are we seeing fentanyl being directly put into party drugs like cocaine and stuff like that? Or is that more of a contact from handling drugs together?
We don't know exactly what's going on there, what's causing fentanyl to show up in party drugs such as cocaine, ecstasy, etc. We know that fentanyl is in BC's heroin supply and right. In the majority of it. So more than 50, it's safe to say more than 50% of heroin in Vancouver, probably more than 70%, includes fentanyl. With cocaine, other drugs like fake OxyContin pills, fake Percocet pills, fake Xanax pills now, those numbers are much, much smaller, but I don't want to instill in people a false sense of security.
Right.
There's not a lot of fentanyl in BC cocaine, but there is some fentanyl in BC cocaine.
Right. I think he's a reporter. He's a drug reporter for Vice. I forget his name. He was arguing on Twitter saying that, no, they're not. It's not being directly put into the cocaine. But if the cocaine is being handled next to the heroin, then it might.
So he may be right. He may be wrong. We
right.
don't know.
Right.
Somehow fentanyl is turning up alongside cocaine. Are dealers cutting it into cocaine to give customers a more addictive product? Or is there an issue of cross-contamination where batches of heroin
exactly.
and cocaine are prepared on the same table and some fentanyl is mixed in accidentally? We don't know. It almost doesn't matter. While the numbers are still small, there is fentanyl turning up alongside cocaine.
Right. Did you read that article that Global published recently saying that a lot of the money being made in fentanyl sales is then being smuggled, sorry, not smuggled, what's the word?
Laundered
into the housing.
Yeah, fentanyl, a deadly product or something like that was the story of that series, I think. Fentanyl making a killing.
Right.
This might be a controversial opinion, but I don't actually spend so much attention on the supply side of the drug problem and the war on drugs. And that,
okay.
and that Global, that series on Global News was well researched. They obviously put a ton of time and staff resources into it. But it concerns almost exclusively the supply side of the war on drugs and the drug crisis. And I personally don't find that very interesting. People have always used drugs. Before fentanyl, it was heroin. Before heroin, it was opium. People have always used drugs, and they always will. And as long as the human race is a capitalist one,
right?
Organized crime is going to step in. I find a much more interesting question on the supply side, government regulation and prohibition. If it were not for prohibition, if drugs were not illegal, they would not be left up to organized crime, and global news wouldn't have that series of stories to run.
Right.
We have a precedent for this now. Just last month, Canada legalized and regulated recreational cannabis. So we know how to do this now. We know how to legalize a drug. We just did it. It would be more complicated to process with hard drugs like cocaine or heroin, but we've just shown last month that it is possible for a country to legalize and regulate drugs. And that's a more interesting side of the supply question, I think. Could we do that? What Canada did with cannabis, with hard drugs.
Right, because I'm seeing, like, I've worked as a reporter in Colombia, so I was seeing what it was, what the effects are on the population there. And we're so far away from each other, but our market here and our consumption here is affecting the lives of peasants out there who are working for drug dealers, or the U.S. who goes and fumigates people's areas and people get sick, or...
Absolutely. So let me ask you a question. The demand for cocaine and heroin products that are grown in countries like Colombia,
mm-hmm.
that demand will always exist in North America.
Exactly.
What if we changed how that demand is met? What if Canada legalized and regulated hard drugs and worked with the government of Colombia to extend regulatory policies and work with suppliers in Colombia, and, you know, instead of destroying coca fields,
right?
What would legalization of these drugs in Canada look like in Colombia?
There's already one of the former presidents of both Mexico and Colombia have argued that they want to see the war on drugs end and see some sort of drug reform in policy. But unfortunately, right now we have Donald Trump, and the president of Colombia right now, Iván Duque, is a hardline right-wing guy who just made weed illegal again.
And so it's a very hypothetical conversation,
yeah,
that
exactly.
we're having.
Yeah.
But what would change? Now, I think cocaine and possibly heroin, poppies, would still be growing in Colombia.
Right.
But with legalization and regulation, would the organized crime element still exist?
Oh, right. So you would allow people to still farm these plants, but the distribution would be met by the government, who would ensure safe products.
Or at least under the regulation of government.
Or some sort of, yeah, it would go into the regulated movement rather than some random narco bringing them into our city.
There wouldn't be a reason for narcos. There wouldn't be a reason for narcos to carry guns.
Right. I saw that your book was reviewed by Gabor Mate. Have you met him?
Oh, many times. Gabor's a good friend of mine.
Yeah, he's very cool. I saw him on Russell Brand recently on the podcast there, and it was really cool. He was talking about how we all deal with our traumas and our own separate addictions. And
His
addiction was shopping.
His seminal work on this subject, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close mm-hmm. Encounters with Addiction, published in 2009, I believe. It was one of those very few books one reads in their life that changed my entire view of the world. It shifted how I look at so much of society, and especially addiction, but the whole world, really.
Right. I just got introduced to him. I saw him in some random YouTube documentaries, and then when I listened to his whole conversation on Russell Brand, I Googled him, and then I saw he lives in Vancouver. He's taught at SFU. I'm like, Jesus, he's right there.
Mm-hmm.
And then no,
he's
I saw
an amazing
that he,
man.
And then I saw that he reviewed your book, and I was like, man, I'm getting closer and closer to these famous people.
I can't recommend Hungry Ghosts highly enough.
Cool.
The seminal work on addiction.
Okay. Do you think that's on Amazon Kindle?
Yes, it is.
Okay, good, because that's what I read on. So we're hitting 20 minutes. How are you feeling for time right now?
You can keep going.
Keep going, cool. What about... Oh, this is an interesting question. Hashtag reframe the blame. What if I died from an overdose right now? Let's say you and me are hanging out right now, and the police decides to prosecute you for the death. So what are addicts doing to avoid that situation of getting their best friend?
Right. So some context. This isn't such a problem in Canada yet, but it's become a huge problem in the United States and is what I would characterize as the most significant intensification of the war on drugs that's occurred in a generation. What's happening is prosecutors across the United States are using a law that was designed to target drug cartels, you know, high-level gangsters, boss, mob bosses. And instead of using that law against, you know, big-level suppliers, they're using it against small-time street-level dealers or even just drug users. So right. How it works is, say you and I are both addicted to heroin, and we decide we're going to inject heroin together tonight. I draw the short straw, so I go out to the corner of Main and Hastings, and I buy heroin for the two of us. We don't know what's in it, because we're in the age of fentanyl, but we're taking a risk because we're addicted. We share the heroin. My batch is fine. I'm okay. Your batch was not. Your batch had some fentanyl in it, and you died. Now, I'm just your buddy. We've been best friends for a long time, but because I brought you the drugs and shared them with you, I can be charged with a murder, a homicide. And that's what's occurring in the United States. And it's occurring when friends use drugs, when...
I saw an article on Vice for the UK and ecstasy, and a bunch of friends are being prosecuted when they're... Exactly what you just said. Pretty much Russian roulette. It's one person's turn to go buy the drugs when they're about to go clubbing. One of their friends overdoses off a drug that they don't know what was in it. And their friend ends up going to jail because they were the ones who bought it that day.
And this is not helping anyone. You know, I get the idea we want to discourage drug use, so let's impose a harsh penalty on it. But this law is being imposed on people who are addicted to drugs, who are using them no matter what. And instead of one life being ruined in an overdose death, we're now ruining two lives for each overdose death, the victim of the overdose and the friend or the romantic partner or the brother or sister or whoever right. who shared with them the drugs.
I saw even the families of like deceased were pleading with authorities in some cases to not prosecute the friend, and the authorities don't give a shit. They need somebody to prosecute so they look good.
Otherwise, there is intense public pressure to punish somebody when somebody dies of an overdose death, and prosecutors are taking that pressure and inflicting this law, the drug-induced homicide charge, on people for which it was not intended. There are wonderful groups of parents across the United States who are speaking about against this. One of the biggest is Families for Sensible Drug Policy, and they are publicly taking positions saying, you know, and this is a group primarily of parents who have already lost children to fentanyl, and this group of parents is saying we don't want other lives ruined in the name of our children.
Right. And what do you think of the... To me, I'm just starting to learn about this whole topic. So to me, it seemed like the downtown East Side was like the center of this. And now I'm starting to read, as somebody who loves journalism and reading the news in general all over the world, I'm seeing that this issue of an opioid crisis and drug overdoses is spreading like wildfire. And when it first started in like the small corners of towns that were decrepit or whatever, suddenly I'm starting to see there's cases of people in middle class and higher class settings who are falling to this overdose culture. What do you think about that?
Yeah, this is a problem in Vancouver that began in the downtown East Side in the poorer part of town, but that's not where it's remained. Not just across British Columbia, but across all of North America, we've seen this opiate crisis, this overdose epidemic, expand far beyond the cities to small towns across both Canada and the United States, and across every socioeconomic boundary you could think of. It's affecting the lower class and it's affecting the upper class.
What's the role of doctors in this? I saw one of your recent articles saying that it's a little bit of a difference in between Canada's doctors and the U.S. doctors, but there's more of a precedent in the U.S. I'll let you explain.
Yeah. There's been, pardon the cliche, but there's been a perfect storm that's occurred here, especially in the United States, where you had a problem where doctors were overprescribing heavy painkillers, opiates like OxyContin. They got a lot of people addicted to those drugs, and then reacted by significantly reducing the numbers of prescriptions they were writing. Good idea in theory, but it had an unintended consequence. Those people who they had gotten addicted to opiates did not simply stop using when their prescriptions were cut off. They kept on using, but now no longer had a clean supply, and so turned to the streets. What did they find? Heroin. But just as they got there, fentanyl arrived. So there's a quick transition from prescription pills, OxyContin, to street heroin, to illicit fentanyl. All of this happened within a decade, and it's created what we call the opiate epidemic. In Canada, most of that story holds true, and there was an overprescribing problem that was kind of at the beginning of it, but it was nowhere near as severe in the United States. And in BC, we've actually had health officials say, we know you're watching CNN, we know you're reading the New York Times and hearing a lot about the role of doctors in this problem. It wasn't quite as severe here. Don't blame the doctors in Canada as badly as you're blaming doctors in America. Vancouver's crisis especially is an illicit fentanyl crisis.
Okay. I guess to wrap it up, we're getting close to the end. What kind of, do you see hope in Vancouver's case right now with the new politicians that just got recently elected? What are their platforms? Do you think we're going to see change anytime soon, or are you optimistic?
I'm very pessimistic about what's happening in Vancouver. The election that you're referring to last October occurred at the city level, at the local level.
Yes.
And in Canada, healthcare is primarily an issue for the provincial and federal, the higher levels of government. And while BC's provincial government has done some good work on this, it's a finger in the dike, which is a good thing. If a dam springs a leak, you want to stuff your finger in it and stop the leak, but that doesn't repair the dam. What we've done with harm reduction, again, a good thing, is stick our finger in the dike, and that's where we stopped. We haven't started repairing the dam. We're going to need the federal government to help us with that, because it's going to be much more expensive to repair the dam than keep someone's finger in there. And we haven't started to talk about actually spending that money, the billions that it will require to create a true treatment on demand, a true treatment addiction system in Canada. I think the reason that we have not begun to have that conversation, the reason we've not begun to spend that money, is because the federal government and not enough voters, they don't care about these lives that we're losing. They don't care about people who are using drugs.
Just quickly, what do you think are some things we desperately need?
We mentioned prescription heroin earlier in the episode. Acknowledging that legalization and regulation of drugs is still probably 10, 20 years off. There's kind of sort of a backdoor around legalization that we can use with prescription heroin and prescription hydromorphone, brand named Dilaudid, a drug very similar to heroin. We need to scale up these medicalized systems that give people clean alternatives to poison drugs they buy on the street. That is happening in Canada, but should be happening much, much faster. And as much as I talk about harm reduction, we need to invest in treatment, true treatment on demand.
What about regular citizens who have no involvement in this world and are prone to frowning at people when they're going down the downtown east side? What do you think, what kind of mental shifts do you think we need to see from...
Well, sadly, there aren't that many people left, at least in Vancouver, who don't have some sort of stake in this crisis. A few years ago, when I started reporting on this, everybody knew someone who died of an overdose. Five years in, everybody knows someone. We need ordinary people pressuring their politicians. You know, as skeptical as some might be, that actually works. When politicians see that they could lose their jobs, by which I mean they could be voted out of office,
mm-hmm.
when people make it clear, when voters make it clear, if you don't start caring about this issue, if you don't actually start doing something that will save lives, you will get politicians' attention.
Right.
Ordinary people need to pressure people in Ottawa, people in Victoria, demanding more action on this.
What has Justin Trudeau said about any of this? He seems to, I don't know, he seems like a typical suit to me, but I'll leave that for another podcast.
Justin Trudeau has done some good work on harm reduction, especially his health ministers. They've allowed injection sites that the previous government, the conservative government, would not allow. But Justin Trudeau and the Liberals have repeatedly said point blank, we will not decriminalize. We for sure will not legalize and regulate hard drugs. They've taken that position over and over again. And it may require another change in government before there's any movement on that.
Has any nation, I know Portugal decriminalized drugs, but has anybody gone full-blown opposite of the war on drugs?
No, Portugal is the closest there is with decriminalization. And Portugal... while a success, it should be noted, has never dealt with fentanyl. The fentanyl crisis has not reached Portugal.
Okay.
And when it does, and it will, I think that you're going to see some real weaknesses in the decriminalization model that Portugal has adopted.
It's not enough.
Fentanyl is a tricky problem, and I think to solve it, as scary as the prospect sounds, I don't know what you do but legalize and regulate.
Right. It's going to take some really progressive stance. I want to thank you for coming onto the show. Usually I just DM people on Twitter, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, and thank you for giving me your time.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find you and your work?
Twitter.com/tlupic, Facebook.com.
I'll tag all that stuff on the show notes.
And fightingforspace.com. You can buy the book there.
Cool. It's on Amazon. Yeah, that's where I got it.
It's on Amazon. It's at Barnes & Noble if you're in the U.S. It's at Chapters Indigo if you're in Canada.
I think I saw last night you have a book signing tomorrow or this weekend?
Saturday. I'll be in the downtown east side at Lost and Found doing a tiny holiday event there.
Cool. I'll tag it. I'll tag any stuff I see.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.